Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer's Picks. On today's show,
we represent another entrance, but we both had a job to do, and that's just to have a satisfied individual when they come in to leave that place.
We feature Howard Johnson, the Deputy Commissioner of the Erie County Board of Elections. And we close with...
Everyone then benefits. So if you're pushing a stroller, if you're, you know, carrying a dolly, if you're, you know, carrying luggage like I often do, you know, to get on the sidewalk, everyone is now benefiting. And so we like to frame it from this idea that it's not just benefiting a certain subset of people, it's really benefiting everyone.
From our Project 2025 series, we feature Akua Menz-Adu and Kim LeVere from the Clementine Gold Group. My name is Dallas Taylor. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Howard Johnson. The two sit down to discuss the importance of voting from both a national and local perspective.
It is unbelievable how many people are going out for early voting. Mm-hmm. But just talk about you. I know you joined the board back in the midsummer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, July.
July. The preparation that goes into getting ready for this time of the year, which of course is obviously your busiest time of the year.
Yeah, so it's a lot of preparation that goes into it. We have the recalibration of the machines, over 1,000 machines. We're ensuring that they're up, ready to go, that there's no glitches with them, ensuring that, you know, everything's in place, setting up our command center to ensure that we have boots on the ground, ready to address any issues and concerns that may be out there during the election process. And, you know, getting the election inspectors trained and getting our staff trained as well, because the same training that the election inspectors get, our staff has to go through it as well on a yearly basis to keep their skills sharp, because there's always a changing environment. We've moved from to the rip-out pads to now the electronic pads. So we have to have that upkeep of training going to ensure that, you know, we are ready and rearing ready to go when the time comes.
And of course, I'm sure a lot of our listeners, if not all of them, know that you're a multi-term Erie County legislator.
Yes.
So that was one area of expertise. But here you are joining the Board of Elections in July in advance of a November election. After people found out that you're on the Board of Elections now, I'm sure you're getting questions and people want to have conversation about it. What are some of the maybe misconceptions that people have, and maybe some of the questions that they have when it comes to
One of the bigger misconceptions, and we find this in the community, the minority community I did represent, is that, you know, what happens if I'm a felon or if I've served my time?
Okay.
So that's one of the bigger questions we've had. And what I would tell them is that, hey, if you've served your time, paid your debt to society, you have the right to vote. Your rights are reinstated to you. But a lot of folks don't know that.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of them think, well, once I've committed this crime, I've done my time, my rights are stricken away from me. New York State is one of the few states that once you've committed your crime, you did your time, your rights are reinstated back to you, and you can re-register to vote. So that's one of the bigger things that's out there. And sometimes just pieces of the election process some folks may not have an understanding of is like the voter registration rules, that, you know, that voter registration ends 10 days before the actual general election. And that was something new that the governor signed into law, Governor Hochul, when she took office, signed into law to extend that time a little further. It used to be 2 weeks. Now it's 10 days prior to the election. So, you know, those are some of the bigger things that we, nuances that I've seen as issues coming into this role.
So, I mean, so the registration process, it's been a long time since I've registered. So it's still relatively easy?
Yeah, very relatively easy.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of partnering organizations who took the time to register to vote, and they had no issue with registering. They was able to get out there and register, you know, as I was receiving from some of these partner organizations, 30, 40, 50 people registered. They was registering at a time. So it was a great turnout to ensure that, you know, we had our citizenry registered to vote and able to participate in the election.
I would have to think for you as both a former county legislator and now part of the elections Board of Elections, that it's got to be pretty gratifying to see new people, right? These are people who have not voted in recent years or maybe never voted, showing up and to vote.
Yeah, and I think that what we see happen nationally has motivated a lot of people to get involved. So I will, you know, charge it to that, that, you know, they're seeing what's happening nationally. And they want to lend their voice to the process. And I think that's the right thing to do. I think we have to have that. I'm all for big turnouts, and, you know, because the bigger the turnout, the better.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. But issues rot. They come to light, and you guys are quick to deal with them. Yep. Can you give me like an example or two of what happened?
We had somebody from the public call and said, hey, I think one of your workers are standing over somebody and it's not taken away from the privacy. And it's not so much that the worker was standing over them. It was that they were there. And sometimes folks from the public have questions.
Ah.
Other folks don't understand who come in on the scene and say, oh, they standing right there. Why are they standing right there?
Because so they have a question. They're filling out their ballot. They want to say, hey, can you help me? I have a question. All right. So that person, that worker will come over and help.
Right. And so what we do is, whatever complaint is, we're going to go to that polling location and find out what happened. What was it?
Okay.
What was it? Then we can assess it and say, well, you know what? They were there helping somebody else. That individual didn't understand that, you know, they were helping somebody.
Sure.
And they weren't looking at their ballot telling them, hey, you should vote for that person. They was there to help them out. So a lot of times, I think sometimes that's the biggest issue that we find is that folks think somebody's looking at their ballot. They're really not. They're there to help somebody. We have a lot of the folks that's coming to vote who might be a little undereducated.
Okay.
Who can't read as well.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is that, you know, because of vision problems and things of that nature, they have some issues.
Yeah, if I didn't have my glasses, I wouldn't read that stuff.
Right,
yeah.
So they're not reading as well. So, interesting. And they can just point out and say, hey, you know what? You know, they might say, who should I be voting for? Now, we can't tell them that.
Right.
We have to tell them, well, whoever you want to. And they'll ask questions. This is a full ballot. Yes, this is a full ballot. You have, you know, our electors across the top. You have propositions at the bottom. And you have school board members on the right-hand side at the bottom. So, you know, just pointing out just small little details, minor details like that. Because we have our voters who have a lot of questions. And they want to be sure about the process. And we want to be there to help.
That's
without
right.
telling them, hey, you should vote for that person.
And interesting, you mentioned it. The board, school board is on this ballot. If I'm not mistaken, this is the first November ballot for the school board. So that it's got to add. I mean, again, you don't have the necessarily perspective from beforehand, but this has got to add a whole different nuance to things.
Yeah, it definitely does add a different nuance to it because that didn't happen. Normally, that school board election, I think, was a primary election.
Yeah.
It was in May.
Yeah.
Actually, before the primaries, it was a standalone election, but they went and lobbied then Governor Cuomo who actually didn't signed the order to actually reduce the signature count for the school board and put it on the ballot in for November.
Yeah, so I think it seems like it's going okay so far.
So far, so good. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Folks are filling out the ballots and, you know, without many glitches.
Yeah, because as you well know, living in the city of Buffalo, those school board races can be pretty intense as well, can't they?
Yes, they can be very, very intense. But, you know, so far, so good. We haven't had any issues or any hiccups with that so far.
You mentioned before one of the things that you're looking upon is when you come in to make sure there's no, I think you used the term electioneering. These are, you know, there are certain things you can and cannot do as a citizen.
Yes.
Or as a worker, of course, inside the polling place. What are some of the things that might be flashpoints or possible flashpoints?
Campaign literature. You can bring campaign literature inside the poll, but you just can't leave it there. You have to take it back out with you. But what you can't do is wear campaign paraphernalia from a candidate inside the polls. You have to come in covered up. You can't come in wearing your favorite, I'm voting for John Smith for whatever office they're running for, your t-shirt on. You can't have that on when you come in there.
Yeah.
So you have to have that covered up. And our poll inspectors are taught, hey, if they come in with that, they have to cover it up. Or go out and turn the shirt inside out. Whatever it is, go in the bathroom, turn it inside out. Because we don't want to give that we're giving preferential treatment to any candidate. Every candidate is equal on that day.
So I guess I'm going to guess that if a certain favorite political bright red hat came in,
exactly.
You might say, please take that off or at least
absolutely.
Put it on.
Okay. Absolutely. You got to tell them that immediately, hey, you can't wear that hat in there, that bright red hat in there, because that would be considered electioneering. And then outside the polls, where they have to be at the 100-foot marker if they're going to hand out campaign literature, you know, we don't want them at the front doors handing out literature as folks walk in. There's a 100-foot marker there for a purpose, so you can be there and catch the voters as they're coming in to hand out whatever candidates are supporting his literature.
And if I'm not mistaken, same with signage and things along those
same
lines?
Same with signage, yeah. Everything behind a 100-foot marker. So everything has to be placed behind a 100-foot marker. And for the most part, going to those polling spots, I've been to all the city polling locations and a few of the towns, they've been set up correctly.
So you've been out to a lot of these polling places. What's the energy like? What's the vibe?
The energy is great. It's great energy. I mean, it's great energy from the poll inspectors to the voters. Everybody is eager to get in and cast their vote and be a part of the process. So that was the bright point of the business of all the election cycle, is that, you know, folks are out, they're energized, and they want to vote.
Yeah. Have you heard from any of your polling inspectors that, hey, oh yeah, I had to tell this person to take that shirt off, that hat off?
No, and surprisingly, we haven't had many of those things. I'm sure it's possibly going to come,
yeah.
But we haven't had that so far. So, you know, it's one of the things, you know, we want to hear from. And the voters will be quick to call and say, hey, we have a hotline. They're quick to call and say, they'll call an AG's office, or they'll call our office and say, hey, this is an issue. And if they did call the AG office, the AG office pushes it right back down to us. Hey, what happened with this? Can you tell us how this was resolved? So it's a lot of checks and balances in place to, you know, kind of diffuse that.
Okay. So, and just so we know, we come into a polling place. We have, is there an inspector on site all the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, in fact, depending on what we think the vote outcome is going to be, there are sometimes 4, 5, 6 election inspectors there, because sometimes it requires that. Might be 2 machines to every, not every polling location, but some polling locations require 2 machines. Some polling locations require 4 machines. So we put our election inspectors in there based on the volume that we anticipate is going to happen at these polling locations.
And are they readily identifiable?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
We know when we go in, that's a polling inspector.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, because they have the yellow tag on, identifying themselves as a poll inspector, the table set up, so you don't have to guess.
All right. But at the same time, we've got polling inspectors, and then we have the individuals who are helping to coordinate things at the tables. Totally different, right?
No, they are polling inspectors as well. Yep, okay. They are polling inspectors.
So if I walk
well.
Up, I say, I'm so-and-so, I think I'm in your district, that person is also a polling inspector.
Right, okay. Exactly. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
All right.
And we have greeters, and you have a greeter at the door, polling inspectors. Now, some candidates will send in poll watchers.
Okay, which is legal.
Which is legal, yeah. They'll send in poll watchers to say, hey, I'm here, how many folks have voted? So, quote unquote, for the integrity of the election, but in Erie County, we don't have many issues here with that. So, you know, our polling inspectors are trained well, and at every polling location is going to be one Dem, one Republican. It should be one Dem, one Republican at those polling locations.
Right.
So if there's one machine, one Dem, one Republican, or 2 Dems, 2 Republicans. So it's going to be an offset.
Right.
Your counterpart is going to be there.
Okay. And just to, when the restrictions are not restrictions, but the kind of rules that govern then the inspectors, they can answer questions, but I mean, there must be a fine line between what they can answer and what they can, I want to use the word suggest, but I think I heard this once at a polling place where someone was kind of guiding somebody toward a certain,
legal.
Yeah, right. But I couldn't hear it quite enough. Right. So I guess, what kind of conversation's okay? What kind is it?
Them helping the voter out, and they have to do it in a partisan manner. So if a voter calls you over,
like I say, who are my choices for Congress?
Right.
Okay.
You can very well tell them, hey, you have 2 choices for Congress, whatever district you're in, but it has to be done in a partisan manner. So you have one Dem, one Republican there. to answer the question. That way, is that you're not suggesting anything. You're not telling a person, you should vote for this person.
Okay. All right. We're with Howard Johnson of the Erie County Board of Elections. If you're familiar with his name, he's also Erie County legislator for District 1, right?
Yes.
District 1, right, in the city of Buffalo. So it really is interesting to hear how the types of etiquette that kind of is governed in there by all these different rules and everybody's on the same page. What about for a voter? Like you said, you haven't heard of any issue when it comes to people dressing a certain way, wearing T-shirts, hats, whatever that might be, supporting one candidate. But let's talk about how they should, should make sure they know. I mean, everybody's got their opinion. We know that when it comes to elections. So let's just use this as an example. I walk into the polling place, and the guy behind me is talking about his favorite candidate who I can't stand. should I reach out to a polling inspector and suggest something? How should I do
mean,
that?
Well, if it's a voter that's talking about a candidate and he's, I mean, that's, yeah, they can say something to a polling inspector, but, you know, we're not advising our polling inspectors to say anything to them as long as they're not bringing in the paraphernalia. Okay. Campaign paraphernalia or their
conversation.
Conversation is that. But if they're too loud, hey, you got to keep your conversation down to a minimum. We have other folks here who are voting. We just want to keep the integrity of the election clean.
Right. And of course, we don't want emotions to run high.
Right. We don't want
as
emotions
we all know
high.
Can happen.
Absolutely. And we just want to, you know, encourage that in a fair and nice manner.
Yeah.
And respectful at that as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you can contact the AG's office. They can also contact the Board of Elections.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hotline number or?
Yes, a hotline number. And I don't
okay, that's fine. And also but the website is what? Erie County?
Yes, it's elections. Erie.gov.
Yeah, there we go. So all that information is right there.
All that information is right there. If they wanted to escalate an issue or anything like that, it's right there, readily available. And it comes to us in real time. And if it comes to us, in our command center, we have it set up so when it does come in, if it's coming from the AG office, if it's coming in from a voter, you know, through the portal, we're going to address it real time as well. We're going to get somebody out there to take a look at it to ensure that, you know, we're doing what we need to do to ensure that's a fair, equitable, and clean election.
At the same time, we're hearing stories from around the country.
Yes.
You and I talked about this a little bit before we went on the air. In a couple of places, some of the early ballot boxes have been burned.
Yeah, and I think that is just, that's the craziest thing I've heard, that they're burning ballot boxes, that they would take somebody's vote and say your vote shouldn't count.
Right.
Not knowing how that person voted. And that's, to me, is insane.
Yeah, but we haven't heard anything along those lines in your
county. Here, we haven't. With us at the Board of Elections, we are in contact with the FBI. We're in contact with our local officials, Buffalo PD, the Sheriff's Office. Our polling locations are prioritized by the Buffalo Police. So if something does happen and a call comes from one of those polling locations, because of how they prioritize, the police is going to be dispatching, be there very, very quickly.
Voter access. This is another interesting thing. I think, as best I can tell, and I don't live in other areas, so I can't say for sure around
right.
the country, but I'm wondering if you have some insight into this. You know, here we have 38 polling places in Erie County,
mm-hmm.
11 in the city of Buffalo, plenty of places to go. It does seem like there's, and with early voting, a lot of people want to avoid the election day line, so they're getting out, and we see this in the thousands. We've already talked about how many people have been out voting. But what do you hear in other parts of the country where maybe the access, the availability to get to polls is not as easy?
Or not so much that because I think that we, you know, other areas have done a good job of ensuring that, you know, folks know where they should be voting at. So I don't think that's much of an issue that we heard. As much as, you know, just the things we did hear about the ballot boxes
right.
and things of that nature, or other areas getting, you know, other boards of elections in other counties and other states receiving, you know, mail that they normally don't receive, and they don't know what's in it. Nothing come of it, but somebody sent it in a package anonymously to make it look like it could be something.
Right, right, yeah. I think I also remember, I'm trying to think which election this might have been, Kerry Bush back in the 2000s in Cleveland. You know, people were lined up trying to get in to vote. Mm-hmm. The assumption was that it was a city vote and that they were probably Democratic voters and they couldn't get in on time, right? So what is the rule then when it comes to the close of the 9 o'clock close of the poll on Tuesday? Is it if you're not in there to vote by 9, or how does that work?
If they're in line, let's just say they're in line.
And the lines comes, around the block.
And lines around the block. We have to, by law, allow all those voters to come in and vote.
Okay. That's the way that works.
Yeah, that's the way that works. If they're in line and it's 9 o'clock, they have to still allow those folks to vote. We can't cut them off and tell them to come back. We have to service every one of those voters.
All right, so just be online.
Right, just be online. Now, if they come there at 9, the door is locked, then no, we're not going to open the door to let them come back in and vote.
Understood.
We can't do that. But if they're in line, there, we got to let them in to vote.
Sure. So,
and our polling inspectors understand that, and they are okay with that.
Do you have some polling inspectors who've been on the job for a long time?
Yeah. We have some very seasoned polling inspectors, someone who's been on the job 20, 30 years. They've been doing it for quite some time, and they know this process like the back of their hand. And even when we had to change from the old paper ballots, they've adjusted well to the new technology. So we have someone seasoned, and they actually been a great source because they've been able to help, train others. Because it's a lot that goes into that training class, and sometimes you may forget things, and you might not have brought your book with you on that day to be an election inspector. And it's good to have somebody who's a seasoned vet to say, hey, I can help you along through the process with that. And, here's the best way to handle that. So that's always a good thing when you have some veterans there.
Right. Of course, you just joined the board in July. Anybody come up to you and take you under their wing a little bit?
The staff has been very helpful, and that's a great thing. Both sides, Dems and Republicans, have been very helpful to whatever my needs are or whatever my concerns are. Everybody wants to say, hey, did you know this? Did you know that? And they'll point things out, and I'm always happy for the information. So everybody's been helpful there, very helpful.
I'm always interested about the Erie County Board of Elections. Again, this is one of those things, being in the news all the time and following it, I know that there's a Republican commissioner, there's mm-hmm. a Democratic commissioner. I'm not sure if everybody understands that, but you've mentioned it a couple of times that that it's a bipartisan effort.
Yes.
Is it fairly collegial inside the Board of Elections?
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. Very cordial, no ruckus. There's nobody, exuding their point of view as a Republican or anybody doing it as a Democrat. When we come there, we know we have a job to do. You represent one interest, we represent another interest, but we both have a job to do, and that's just to have a satisfied individual when they come in to leave that place. So that's the basis of it. And that's what we strive to do there.
Yeah. Do you ever think that you should be able to... Too bad we can't take what goes on at the Board of Elections and put it in maybe the state legislature or the U.S. Congress?
Right. Exactly. But, we'll work on that.
Okay. We'll focus on
that. We'll work on it and say, hey, we should be the standard bearer for how these things operate. But, there's no issues there, nothing of that nature there. Nobody, there. Everybody gets along fairly well there. And, we all got a job to do, and we understand that.
That was Howard Johnson, the Deputy Commissioner of the Erie County Board of Elections. And we close out with Jay Moran sitting now with Akua Menzadu and Kim LeVere of Clementine Gold Group from the second installment of our Project 2025 series. The three discussed the potential impact of the project on DEI.
And of course, first of all, I'll just kind of remind people or just kind of outline Project 2025, about a 900-page report that all talks about the transition of a conservative presidency in 2025 and outline some, I don't think it's wrong to say extreme approaches to federal government. Just also to point out that the Trump-Vance administration or ticket has somewhat distanced themselves from this, but yet they most certainly have embraced certain policies inside Project 2025. What we want to get into, though, with the Clementine Gold Group, because your mission, unique set of skills and experience in equity, inclusion, consensus building, and engagement practices, DEI would be another way of describing it.
Yeah.
And DEI is woven throughout Project 25, and at least to say, not exactly embracing DEI, right?
Right.
What? Tell me about what you've been hearing about it, what you've been seeing about Project 2025.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that this is an extreme set of measures that set to really attack it from a policy standpoint as it relates to DEI. In general, we know that DEI is under attack in this country. There's a lot of folks that are co-opting words and really making it mean something that's completely different than what it was intended to be. And so in the Project 2025 framework, it really is highlighting a lot of different ways that it aims to attack it from a federal level. I mean, in general, they're looking to get rid of a lot of these terms and, you know, connection to the work that's being done at the federal level and rolling that back. And so we see it as a measure that, you know, we need to get the word out around how this is really going to be detrimental to everyone, right? When we think about DEI, it's not just a certain set of folks that get to benefit from it. It really is laying the groundwork for everyone to benefit from DEI efforts.
And it's interesting how you mentioned co-opting of words and terms that are associated with DEI. And this might be a great way just to kind of start our conversation. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of move into some of the, or kind of weave that into, you know, what is involved in Project 2025. But when you say terms that are being co-opted, mm-hmm. what are you talking about?
I mean, DEI in general, right?
Right.
And so we're seeing different terms that are being used, like didn't earn it, right? That's one of the biggest things that we're hearing as it relates to DEI. Anything come to mind for you, Kim?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of terms that are used for DEI at this point, right? Like whether you think someone is a DEI hire, we have a DEI card that gives us some sort of benefit at this point.
Woke
being sort of weaponized,
right.
It's problematic. And I think, when you really break down DEI, you know, from sort of this abstract high level term into more tangible actions or sort of the stories around it, it's much easier to embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about things like, you know, is it everyone having, you know, a safe place to live or, you know, having access to a job that pays a fair wage or, you know, your children having access to, you know, equal play at recess. You know, I think that people can get behind things like that. But when you sort of make it this abstract concept and you weaponize it, it seems as though, and you make it exclusionary, it seems as though there are folks that don't benefit. So, you know, ultimately there is some bumping.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and you talk about your work also when it comes to DEI, the benefits of it, because, you know, like you said, I mean, you've both touched on a couple of the terms that are not really all that nicely stated for sure.
Right.
But there's more to it than just, you know, making sure that, like you said, you want to make sure everybody's treated equitably. Basically, that's what it comes down to. But beyond that, though, there is a lot of education that's going on for a society, it seems to me, that there's been that there's parts of their education that have been shut off or just ignored for generations.
Right. Right. I think one of the biggest things, you know, as it relates to teaching folks about DEI is exactly, you know, who benefits. And we look at it from everyone benefiting. The curb cut effect is something that we often teach in our sessions around DEI. And the curb cut comes from the American Disability Act. Right. And so it's stated that we're putting these cuts in the curb so that folks that have disabilities can access the curb in a way that is beneficial to them. Right. But what they found was that by doing that curb cut, everyone then benefits. So if you're pushing a stroller, if you're, you know, carrying a dolly, if you're, you know, carrying luggage like I often do, you know, to get on the sidewalk, everyone is now benefiting. And so we like to frame it from this, you know, idea that it's not just benefiting a certain subset of people, it's really benefiting everyone, right? And so what do you think, Kim?
Right. And I think there are curb cuts that you can look at in a lot of different areas that I think people don't
using
really
it as a metaphor.
Consider.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. You know, because curb cut effect sort of becomes this umbrella term that means, you know, something that you've done for a particular population that benefits everyone. You know, I always say things like Netflix captions, you know, who doesn't enjoy, you know, being able to see the captions? They obviously are made for a particular group, but we all benefit from them. Mm-hmm. You know, having different ergonomic furniture, Target Drive Up is technically
one of her faves.
and you know, I mean, you guys are considerably younger than I am, but I can remember when the ADA passed, and I can remember the onslaught of reaction against it before it even became law, that this is going to drive businesses out. It's going to do this, that, and the other thing. And here we are now, 30 years later, I think more than 30 years later. And it is something that is totally embraced in society.
Yeah.
So you would say, as a someone who is DEI, your business is about DEI, that 20 years from now, if we could stay this course and making sure that there is diversity, equity, and inclusion, a discussion going on in all facets of society, that we'd be a better place.
Absolutely, right? Without a doubt. And I think that's the biggest thing about all of this. We are seeing studies that say when you start to break this down, so you take this from this abstract level of, you know, a word and break it down into nuances for everyday folks, they embrace it, right? And that's what we try to do as practitioners in this space, is take it from this abstract word into your everyday practice within organizations, right? And so when you talk about pay equity and people getting paid fairly, a living wage for the work that they're doing, not many people are going to say, no, you don't need that, right? Like, you're going to embrace that. And so when you start to say, you know, if you are having a child and you have a pregnancy leave or, you know, paternal leave afterwards, no one's going to really say that that's not a good thing, right? And so I think that's the biggest thing about all of this work, is taking it from this word that's now being co-opted and used as a scary term to saying, hey, everyone is benefiting, right? And this is something that we can all get behind, for sure.
I'm wondering, in your work, when you're going out to, whether it's companies or other organizations, do you see maybe inside these discussions, do you get pushback from people who might be coming from that angle, for lack of a better term, we'll just call it the Project 25 angle, looking for kind of these nuances of things to push back upon and somehow make it into a different discussion than it's meant to be?
You know, I see you have some ideas already.
Well, I think it comes up sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious how it does, though, and what you sense for it, and maybe how you overcome it, but continue. I'm sorry for
interrupting. Yeah, no, I think some of it is, you know, just sort of fear or not necessarily understanding what, you know, we're trying to implement, or a little bit more around, like, fear of losing, like, their status quo within their organization.
Yep.
You know, they've been at a certain level, they've enjoyed certain privileges, and, you know, if someone else is able to come in, does that mean I lose all of those privileges?
Right.
And we try to make a point that we're just expanding benefits for others. It's not about taking something away from someone else.
Is that a common concern?
I think so, right? Like, there's you know, Kim mentioning this fear, I think there's a lot of fear-based conversations that are had around this. And so what does that mean if others have the opportunity to now grow within an organization and you know, really implement things and ideas that they might have? And so I would say in some of the trainings, you know, there's folks that are quiet and you can tell, right? Like, there's something that's going on there and you're not quite sure. They're not really participating in the conversation. And I think the reactions that we hear is, like, you know, some folks might not know where they fit in this conversation. And so if you're talking about DEI and it's been this term that's been used to say, oh, these certain people, whether it's sexual orientation, gender, race, are supposed to be benefiting from the conversation, then me as this straight white man might not have a place in this. And we are, you know, saying, no, you do, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that is also going to benefit you. When we think about organizations that have diversity at the helm, they're more successful. We're seeing more innovative ideas that are coming because you get to challenge each other and talk about your own lived experience that might make something better, right? Like when we think about equitable decision making, it's making sure that everyone has an opportunity to contribute. And these are the things that we are operationalizing within organizations, right? It's the way that you do work, inclusive working agreements. How are you going to handle conflict when it arises, right? And we know that folks coming from different cultures approach these things in a different way. So how do we make sure that the table is set in which everyone can contribute and challenge the idea to make it a lot better?
Right. And from these inclusive working agreements and, you know, these new sort of cross-collaborative groups, mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like that, we're seeing increased profit margins
exactly.
for a lot of organizations at a time where, you know, when you think about inflation and all of these things, you know, increased profits and bottom lines and, you know, potential benefits for your employees mm-hmm. is a great benefit.
Absolutely.
And so you are seeing or hearing from some of the organizations that you're working from that it's the DEI training is achieving more than just, and I don't want to say than just, mm-hmm. but than helping kind of everybody understand each other a little bit better.
Yeah.
But they're actually seeing bottom line.
Oh, yeah.
Success.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those that really embrace it, for sure.
Right. And so I think one example that I can think of, there's an organization we were working with, and they were looking at diversifying their workforce because it was predominantly white, you know, and they were trying to get into certain areas within the community that they weren't reflecting. Mm. And so that was one of the things that we worked with them on is, you know, the whole process around hiring. What did that look like? We found that there were a lot of discrepancies in terms of their approach to interviews. We found that there were discrepancies in their approach to hiring in general. And so different folks were being asked different questions that
really?
Wasn't necessarily outlined in the same way. And so one of the things that we worked with them on was actually establishing this rubric where they're answering questions ahead of time, right? And you're putting this in a format that then made the process much more equitable. And we found that that organization where they were, what was the percentage?
So, you know, once we implemented this, we sort of ran our, you know, our pilot through mm-hmm. And we increased their diverse candidates by 300%.
Yeah.
And they were able to tap into new markets, which meant, you know, new business,
right.
new contacts, new partnerships. So ultimately, you know, all of that works out well.
Absolutely.
Wow. It's a fascinating element to this for sure. We're talking this morning with Akua Menz Adu and also Kim LaVere from the Clementine Gold Group. We brought you in to talk about Project 2025. Mm-hmm. I'm interested. I'll let you take this where you want. You know, we talk about the benefits of DEI, and now we're seeing kind of this backlash, and mm-hmm. a backlash that now with the Project 25 has almost gone to a whole new level. Just a glance through it, you know, well written, well documented mm-hmm, mm-hmm. piece of report. But from your perspective, where is it being generated from?
I mean,
is it just a political maneuver to try to capture a certain, you know, voting percentage across the country, or is it coming from someplace that's, you know, maybe a little bit more of the traditional part of America that
yeah.
is
yeah.
not always the best part of America?
Yeah, I think you're saying it exactly right in your latter statement, because one of the things that we're finding is that you know, we're becoming a plurality nation, and that means that we're not going to have a single ethnic or racial majority in this country. And it's already happening in larger cities. The city of Buffalo, for instance, is 53% people of color
right.
and 47% white. And so that's due to the increase in new Americans that are coming into our community. And we find that when you have new Americans, they're hardworking, right? They want to, you know, promote growth within a community and society. And when you read this Project 2025, you're seeing that they're trying to reverse a lot of that that's already happening, right? It's going to continue to happen. Maybe this will delay some of that growth and opportunity, but I think that a lot of what Project 2025 is saying is relating to, you know, reversing some of the work that has been done around DEI efforts. And so relating to gender, sexuality, and race, and it aims to end most of the federal government's efforts to achieve equity and mostly collect data that could be used to track outcomes across both public and private sectors. And so when you do that, you lose the ability to even track that progress in general, right? And I know Kim and I talk about that often, the SOGI data and how important that is for progress.
Right. But in terms of like who this is sort of targeted to, I think it's targeted towards people who think they're left behind sort of the DEI movement. You know, I think there's such a focus on sort of, you know, leveling the playing field that some folks who have previously benefited feel as though there's not a place for them. But I think that, you know, for DEI to really work, everyone has to be a part of it. Like, we all have to work together to, you know, sort of move the needle on all of those goals.
It's interesting to say, talk about people who have benefited from it, but there's also a fairly significant, it seems to me, backers of what, in essence, Project 25, 2025 might appeal to, of people who really aren't benefiting from the current playing field, even though they might be white, you know, rural, whatever. What do you make of that? I'm wondering. And again, I'm throwing out some different things here, but I think we have a good conversation kind of going on here about you know, two different sides of this that really need to, you know, find a way to move forward.
Yeah, I think when you hear that, right, like those folks that you're mentioning, and, you know, they might be white, but when I think about it from a socioeconomic standpoint, you know, they're not necessarily benefiting from the current state of affairs either. And so they probably have a lot more in common with the folks that this Project 2025 is aiming to, I don't want to say like get rid of, but silence. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the biggest things that this country has seen is when you get folks who can connect on that level, it makes it that much more of a powerful movement. And that's something that would not benefit those who are already at the top. Right. And that's the overarching conversation, I think, that connects those two groups together.
Yeah, I think, you know, the focus on villainizing DEI has really focused on trying to other groups.
Yeah. Mm.
And that sort of siloing and that fear-based rhetoric is really pushing, I think, all of these responses, right? Because I think that we do have more in common with each other than there are differences.
Right.
And it is another part of it also. I mean, there's so much to get into here, but in essence, demonizing the people who identify in a non-binary gender. That is another thing that, again, talk about silence. That, when you read it in a certain context, that almost feels like you said, an almost erasure of people who have identified in a certain way.
Yeah, to me that feels like some of the most dangerous language because I know, you know, we have friends who identify, you know, along the spectrum for gender expression and identity, and just thinking about how hard they've worked to, you know, be recognized, to get benefits, to, you know, just be able to live. It just sort of feels as though Project 2025 is trying to decide who is looked at as human and who is not. And that feels really dangerous.
Yeah, it does. And I would say that, you know, in the context of Project 2025, their aim is to take the following terms out of every rule and regulation. And so we talk about SOGI data in the healthcare space where we both come from previously. It is something that we rely on to make decisions, right? When you're able to disaggregate data to that extent, you can then see who's being left behind, whose outcomes aren't the greatest, right? And those are things that in healthcare and other sectors we depend on to make decisions around things like resources and just where we need to put more efforts in. And so the Project 2025, it says that they need to take out terms of every rule and regulation, and that includes SOGI, so sexual orientation and gender identity, DEI, gender, gender identity, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive rights, reproductive health and reproductive rights. And so if you get rid of all those terms and we can't take note of, you know, where people fall in line in that spectrum, then what does that mean? It means that people who are already marginalized become even further marginalized mm-hmm. and disenfranchised by our current systems that were built, you know, by people who might have different biases, right? And so we've made so much effort to be able to find those different pockets so that we can rightfully put things together in order to make them better, right?
What do you see inside that data that you'd have access to right now? What are the things that you might think are, you know, kind of hidden elements mm-hmm. that people that really need to be highlighted when it comes to understanding, you know, how current policies or how traditional policies have impacted people, like you said, that are marginalized? What are we seeing?
Yeah, I think, you know, a great example of that is something that we all recently went through, right, which is the COVID, you know, pandemic. Mm. And so when I think about it from a healthcare standpoint, we know that folks who are already marginalized had a harder time and the death rates were a lot higher for those folks than it was for folks that might not have been in that situation. Right. And so when we looked at the data, especially coming from the healthcare organization we were working in, we found that there were certain communities that suffered more. When we looked at 14215, which is predominantly East Side, you know, community, they had higher rates than the other folks that we were servicing in that specific space. And so if you can't say that, you know, these things are happening, then you can't put something in place to really make sure that those folks are getting more support and help, right? It doesn't make sense to use limited resources for folks that don't necessarily need it. And so when you're able to disaggregate and find that there's certain pockets within communities that are suffering more, then you put resources behind those that need it the most, you know?
Absolutely. It's interesting to hear it phrased in that regard, because mm-hmm. It seems almost, after, you know, it's something now that this element of Project 2025 is talking about kind of eliminating something that we've all become very accustomed to and very comfortable with, identifying ourselves in certain ways.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a odd development in terms of that. I mean, I always keep wanting to kind of come back into, like, from where does that really stem? Is it, like you said, just you really feel it's kind of coming from this kind of dark place that just says, we want to just, people who are marginalized already, that's fine.
Yeah.
Let's keep it going.
I think, you know, one of our values as a company is from the margin to the center.
Okay.
And that's because there's many voices and people that don't get the rightful attention that they need to thrive and have a prosperous life, right? I think when we have this notion of what the American dream is that everyone has access to, you know, affordable healthcare. They have access to a house, right, that they can live in. You can thrive in these conditions, right? You're making enough money. You have education. You have access to all these things. Because when we look at it, you know, we can tell that if based on your zip code, we can tell your life expectancy. And why is that? Right. You know, healthcare is only 20% of someone's overall health. All the others come from social and environmental positions that we all face. So if I can say, because I live in this zip code, you know, my life won't get to thrive as someone else who lives in a different zip code, that's a real issue there, right? But when you start to take away some of that, then what does that mean? That those folks that are on the margins, they don't have the same, you know, space to really thrive in life. And so I don't know where, you know, this originates from, but we know that people create systems and they design systems. Bias is baked into everything that we do because we all have bias, right? And so when you start to diminish the opportunities for that to be at the forefront, that means that those folks who are already struggling will continue to struggle. And who's benefiting from that? I think that's the question that, you know, you can answer and deduce from who's designing it, right?
Yeah. The interesting part, some of the reporting about Project 2025, but basically, a core of it is that DEI is being characterized as a violation of anti-discrimination laws.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? I mean, when you talk about discrimination in this country,
yeah.
and to suggest that finding ways to be more equitable
yeah.
is discriminatory.
Well, I can think of a prime example, and this is something that we've been following in the DEI space. And I don't know if you've heard of the Fearless Fund, but it comes from, it's a fund that was created by two Black women in the Atlanta area. And they were really trying to put opportunities together for businesses that were created by, you know, folks of color. And so they had this grant program where they were giving $20,000 to, I think it was female, Black female founders, yeah. Because we know that venture capital, they get less than 1% mm-hmm. of venture capital in the country. And so they were creating this fund to really, you know, basically like be that bootstrap arm, friends and family arm of funds that go out to those businesses. And Edward Blum, who was a conservative activist who went after affirmative action at the education level, was now trying to attack it at this level. And so one of the things that we've seen is that when you attack that, they were trying to make a precedent across the country where race-based, you know, race-based concepts were now being pushed back. And so if you can do it at that level, then you can make sure that race-based isn't being included in a lot of different areas. And there's a lot of organizations, foundations and alike who are now trying to revert back from that because, you know, there's this fear around getting in trouble because the Supreme Court has now made this case, right? You know, I think there's a lot of things that we have to take into consideration as it relates to race, but you have folks who are now trying to turn this into something else, right? They're using the Civil Rights Act to say that now you're discriminating against other folks, when in reality it was put in place because there's such a disparate, you know, outcome already that's happening in the country based on our systems.
Right. And it's also based on history. But I think, you know, the more that we fight against having any sort of history taught in schools, and you know, Project 2025 specifically says that, you know, there will be no further discussions right. about any of that. And, you know, there's sort of that quote, like, you're doomed to repeat history if you don't learn about it.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one of those examples, mm-hmm. like going after this, not thinking about
how we got here in the first place.
How we got right. here in the first place, right. and also the real landscape, the real opportunities, the real deficit of like network gap and, mm-hmm, you know, things mm-hmm. like that.
And the network gap is something, it's the same thing, right? We can tell someone's success based on their zip codes. Mm. You know, we often talk about your success being those folks that are around you, like the, you know, five or six most people yeah. that you're around. But we can determine that if you're in a zip code where there aren't that many successful people, you're doomed to be in that same category, right? And so what we also find around the data is if you don't measure it, it doesn't matter. And you can't take that into consideration. And so one of the things that Project 2025 aims to do is to get rid of the collection of all this data at the federal level, all these different institutions. And if you're not measuring it, it doesn't matter. And you can't, you know, fix it. You can't center that
right?
in the conversation.
And for some organizations, that federal measurement, you know, the EEO-1 mm-hmm, data mm-hmm. is the only thing that they use to measure. So all of a sudden, the ways that you're measuring, you know, your hiring, your promotions, your onboarding and offboarding, if there's no data, you can just say you're doing great.
Mm.
And it talks about that, right? It says at the CDC level, Project 2025 wants to reverse them from even collecting that data. And so think about that. We just had a pandemic. If we weren't able to look at the data and see who was dying at higher rates and what was happening around that, we couldn't really target those communities with preventative measures and, you know, things like the vaccination, right? Like, so those are the types of things that this would aim to end, which just means that, like I said, the folks that are already marginalized will continue to fall further and further behind.
We're talking with Akua Menz-Adu and also Kim LeVere. Kim is the managing director of Clementine Gold Group, and Akua is the founder and also the president of it as well. Their focus is on DEI, and we are focusing on Project 2025. We've touched on some different elements of this as well. Akua, you mentioned, of course, healthcare and how mm-hmm. the need for data that Project 2025 basically promotes changing in the federal government and just basically eliminating that data. What about from an education standpoint? I think Project 25 wants to eliminate the Department of Education just to start, but also what can be taught? And this is a debate that's been going on now for some time about what can be taught in schools, and some states have made their own way. You know, what do you see when it comes to that type of subject?
Yeah, I think the other notion under Project 2025 is to also dismantle Title IX. And so Title IX was a federal civil rights law in the U.S., and it was enacted a part of the Education Amendment in 1972. And it really prohibited discrimination based on sex in any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And so the aim around Project 2025 is also to roll that back as well.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Title IX, because under Title IX, if I understand it, basically has made women's sports in colleges or any federally funded college or college has made those programs, they had to be funded on the same level
exactly.
as men's.
Yep.
And it's interesting that we're at this time now that we have seen now an explosion of women's sports.
Absolutely.
And think about, I mean, again, I was 10, I think, when Title IX came out. But, you know, the idea that the complaints at the time were, well, this is just a waste of funds. Why are we doing this? You know, and I won't get into some of the other things that we probably heard over the times. But just to reflect on that idea that, look at all of a sudden, there's a huge market
absolutely.
For women's sports.
Absolutely.
And 50 years ago, nobody believed that was going to be the case.
Right. I mean, look at the WNBA, for instance. I know a lot of folks have been paying attention to that, but there's an expansion of teams that are happening now across the country and Canada as well. And so there are folks who are obviously interested. It's been an exciting time to watch. I mean, you're seeing star players, these rookie players that are coming in and elevating the level of the game as well, which has been really cool. But, you know, I'm a former athlete at University at Buffalo. And so I remember, you know, you have a football team that is made up of all men, and they're getting a lot of money and funds and scholarships. Title IX was something that definitely deepened the opportunity around sports for women. And we saw other opportunities, right? We're getting different grants and different scholarships now because of that ruling and what that looked like over time. And so, you know, one of the things is in Title IX is around like sexual discrimination, right? And so it aimed to eliminate gender-based discrimination, ensuring that no one is denied participation or benefiting from educational programs. And so to roll that back means that we're rolling all the progress that happened with that back as well. And so I think there's a lot of things that we have to consider as it relates to that.
And it also shows, I would like to thank, you know, kind of getting back to a part of this conversation we had at the start, that it shows you the possibility, I shouldn't probably give it a label, but of a progressive initiative from 50 years ago that has benefited everybody in society and has really changed the look of society.
Right.
And it seems, again, not to overcharacterize, but Project 2025 kind of seems to me, it looks to kind of roll back some of that progress and maybe stunt progress that has been made.
Yeah. Another area under Title IX that, you know, Project 2025 would eliminate is the sexual harassment and violence component of that. And so it addresses sexual harassment and violence within educational institutions as well. And so schools had to respond now to prevent incidents of sexual misconduct, creating safer environments for students as well. And so when I think about athletics even, right? Think about the U.S. gymnasts that just went through this really large case around some of the you know, misconduct that was happening there. This wouldn't be addressed, right? Based on what Project 2025 aims to do.
And that will do it for Producers Picks. We thank our guests, Howard Johnson, Akua Menzadu, and Kim LeVere. If you missed anything or you want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. And each episode is also online at WBFO.org. I'm Dallas Taylor. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Hey people, Corey here with Compact Civics. It's funny how the things we need the most are usually the hardest to find. Like your car keys when you're running out the door, that missing sock that didn't make it through the laundry, or most importantly, trying to find your polling place so you can vote in an election. We can help with that last one. Here's a quick guide on polling locations. A polling place is where you cast your ballot during elections. In America, the term polling place refers to the building, while polling station refers to the specific room or area where voting happens. So, a school might be your polling place, but the gymnasium is the polling station. Did you know the location can influence your vote? Research shows that the building's condition, name, or even decor can subtly sway voter behavior. And long lines can even keep people from casting their vote. While many states still use voting booths, others offer mail-in voting options. The goal is to make voting easier and more available to everyone that is eligible. So, while I can't help you find that other sock, I can help you find your polling place. In New York, visit voterlookup.elections.ny.gov. Remember, your vote is your voice. Make sure you're prepared and know where to cast your ballot.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.